Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, July 31st, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, a weekly program of media analysis from the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab and a member of the Convergence Journalism faculty at MU. Joining me this week are J-School colleagues Esther Thorson, the Associate Dean for Graduate Studies, and Stephanie Padgett from our Strategic Communication faculty. Esther and Stephanie are both experts in advertising and marketing. On our agenda this week, Bradley Manning avoids the most serious verdict in his court-martial, but the outcome could mean more pressure on future whistleblowers. Two of the world's largest advertising conglomerates want to merge. How would the deal affect their clients and the way they promote our favorite products? A large radio station group may be about to dump Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity. While liberals are crowing, the talk show landscape may not really change that much. While television newsrooms have done a better job than newspapers of hiring and promoting women and minorities, the latest numbers show little progress in the past year. And NPR's Scott Simon shares on Twitter the last hours with his dying mother. Well, the military judge in the Bradley Manning case announced yesterday she was acquitting the WikiLeaks data dump source of the most serious charge brought against him, aiding the enemy. But she found Manning guilty of violating the Espionage Act. Colonel Denise Lind heard testimony in the punishment phase of his court-martial today. She could sentence the Army private to a very long term in a military prison. The chairman and ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee say justice has been served. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who himself is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for fear he'll be extradited to the U.S., calls Manning a hero and President Obama a national security extremist. Free press advocates were particularly worried about the aiding the enemy charge, but many say that Manning's conviction under the Espionage Act will have a chilling effect on future whistleblowers, especially if the U.S. government gets its hands on Assange or Edward Snowden. The WikiLeaks leader and the former NSA contractor both took the classified documents they accessed directly to the media. Well, Esther, let's talk first about your general reaction to the Manning verdict and what, if anything, it might mean for the media and for whistleblowers.
Well, I can't imagine that it would not have a chilling effect on them, because what this means is that if you discover malfeasance on the part of your government, there may be some channels you can go through, but going directly to the media is going to land you in prison for a long time.
I think that, at least, Stephanie, there was some sense that maybe the Manning verdict itself, there was kind of a sigh of relief because he wasn't convicted of aiding the enemy. But if you add that up to all the other instances, reporters being spied on, James Risen from the New York Times basically being said he's going to have to turn over sources, when you add it all up, it's very discouraging in terms of what the Obama administration is doing with regard to leakers.
Yes, and I've even heard discussions that if, as a media outlet, you play or share the materials that were leaked, you could be held liable as well. So if you carry that through to, I have it, but can I share it, those implications are pretty scary.
I have to say, it was interesting to me that there was a bipartisan group from Congress that was supposed to today hear from journalist Glenn Greenwald. You may recall that he was a supporter of both Manning and Snowden and brought some of Snowden's documents out in the Guardian in the UK. Well, he was supposed to be talking with Congress today, some members of Congress, but they canceled the hearing after President Obama said he wanted to meet with House Democrats. Whatever that means, I don't know, and maybe that hearing will happen later. Well, I'm particularly pleased to have Esther and Stephanie here with us this week, because our next topic involves right where there is in their wheelhouse, practicing and researching advertising and marketing. On Sunday, two advertising conglomerates, New York-based Omnicom Group and Paris-based Publicis Group, announced that they plan to merge. If regulators let them, the combined firm would be the biggest in the world. If the two media giants like, you know, say News Corp or Disney ABC wanted to merge, I suspect, Stephanie, that we'd be hearing an awful lot about it. That would be a huge and hugely controversial story. And I just wonder if the Omnicom Publicis deal is on that same kind of scale. How big is this in terms of the advertising industry and the impact it might have on clients and customers?
I think it is a huge deal. This would they would be double the size of the WPP group, which is the current largest. There is a lot of discussion that the French regulatory boards will probably be more critical and tough in reviewing the matter, as that French company would now become an American traded company. And it is really there's a lot of discussion of whether they can obtain the scale that they hope to do through merging two such large organizations. Does the media industry even reward or need that kind of scale? Or will it make them so large that they're not nimble enough to compete with many of the startups that are using the new technology? So
let's talk about that a little bit more. And Esther, I mean, how integrated is today's advertising business? And how large are the key players in it?
Well, it's, you know, there's been conglomeration for the last 25 years in the business. So they're very, you know, most agencies belong to some big holding company. But I think what really matters, I mean, the agencies still operate quite independently. So in that sense, you know, getting all advertising that looks exactly the same is not a problem. But I think the real reason that they've done it is that it gives them much more power to buy upfront advertising from television, because the bigger the buys you make, see, they have, what they do is the agencies operate independently in creating the creative, you know, the ads themselves, but then they all go together to make the buys. And the bigger the company making the buys, the more you can press TV to lower its prices.
So rates could be coming down for TV networks and local stations?
Well, what's interesting is that is the model that Group M, which is the WPP buying department, has done. They have consolidated and they use their muscle to negotiate primarily network TV, where that's the biggest amount of dollars in play. Mm-hmm. What's interesting as you move forward, the share of spending to network TV has been decreasing at the expense of mobile, digital, and other things such as social media. So what's interesting is they've hedged their bet against an area that's declining. You asked about the size, and I believe they've said estimates could be that roughly 40% of the ad dollars spent total would fall under the new Publicom umbrella. But those two agencies separately, as Esther has pointed out, have not really consolidated their media. They have kept it independently and not had that leverage. So if they intend to do that, they'll have to change their formula to look more like WPP's model, which will be very interesting to see if that's the route that they take.
Well, that's a good point, and I suspect they will, because one of the best reasons to merge is so you can get rid of personnel, right? So they're going to cut every place they can for further efficiencies. And so that's really the only reason to merge, as far as I can see.
Now, the leaders of both companies came out as the merger was announced, and they said that the real reason behind it was because of all the changes in advertising technology and the increasing importance of big data. Does that make sense to you as a reason why they wanted to come together? And how big are those changes in technology and sort of the analytics behind it on in terms of how advertising is practiced today?
I think it's huge. The field of media, especially your online advertising, is bought like a commodity now. It's called real-time bidding or exchanges. And so all three of us can come with our money on the table and bid, and it's a much more democratized way to buy and sell media. If I bid for 10 bucks and you bid for 9, I win. It doesn't matter that you're Procter & Gamble and I'm a little startup. So the interesting thing is, in that world, at least in the buying and selling of media, the use or commoditization of the buying process doesn't give them that same scalability that you see in the TV market. So that change and their rationale somewhat conflict, and there's a whole lot of discussion about whether or not size matters anymore.
Well, you know, the other thing that's really important is that the whole nature of advertising is threatened because it's a mass medium for the most part. We do targeting in advertising, but we don't target right down to individuals. That's where the big data comes in. Mm-hmm. Google ads go straight to you or me or to Stephanie. And the ad agencies are greatly threatened by that, because that means the value of a TV ad that goes to millions of people is greatly lowered, whereas an ad that goes just straight to you for a Ford or whatever is going to probably be what moves that car off the lot.
Well, with that said, then, is this merger more aimed at trying to compete effectively against Google and Yahoo and Facebook and Twitter as much as WPP or some other ad agency?
They are definitely in that space of trying to get into the digital space and leveraging data. And having big clients gives you lots of access to data. However, those clients are usually very, that's their data. It is not the agency's. So yes, I know who drinks Coke and I know what music they like, but can I parlay that to help Sprint or Verizon? I'm not sure. The magic happens when you take the data from your client, the data from the third-party providers, such as Google and Facebook, and you kind of mix it with a secret sauce. The agencies can take that mixing and the secret sauce, but typically that data is, you know, owned by the companies, and they don't want to necessarily give that up, and the agencies don't own that data.
Well, that's a good point. And they don't have as much expertise to work with the data. So mm-hmm. they don't have the people that can create these algorithms that can deliver very specific ads to you and follow you all over the place to do it. But I think the interesting thing to me is, you know, we still need that creative message, because even though I'm delivering you a Ford Motor message, what do I say to you? Well, what do I say to you is best answered by an ad agency. They have that expertise. So the question will be, does that expertise balance out against this way of using big data so that you can target so specifically?
Stephanie, you mentioned a particular brand, Coke, and it's pretty interesting because Coke at the moment is under one holding company and Pepsi is under yes. another, but under the merger, they would be under the same holding company,
correct.
Omnicom Publicis. Any reason why they or some of the big telecom companies are in that same boat or other clients should be worried about this or complaining about this merger?
I think the clients have yet to weigh in. It is not uncommon that within the holding companies today, you'll see walls built between groups. In fact, it's kind of fun up in Chicago. OMD and OMG was created because OMD had Intel, OMG had HP, and so they built artificial walls, if you will, and some physical walls to keep those accounts separate. And so they have done this in the past successfully. However, it's not been as large and on the same scale. So it'll be interesting. But as they consolidate, it's going to be harder and harder to find agencies that don't have some type of conflict.
Well, exactly. But the good thing for the clients is that they can then bargain for lower prices because they can claim that their secret sauce is more threatened because of this porousness with a merged company.
Well, so what about the merger just on its own? I mean, there are some people who are suggesting when you have two rivals who are basically equals merging, no matter what the industry, that doesn't typically work very well. You even had concerns about, I saw one article we have on our blog, the culture clash between the American-based Omnicom, the cowboys, and the French-based socialists, you know, in Publicis. Is there any reason to worry about the merger actually being an effective merger in this because of those factors?
Well, I think you've already seen it when they tried to acquire a lot of the digital startups. And so you have fast-moving startups that are digitally minded. They work in that space. And when they've bought them, because they understood this was where we're going, those cultures have clashed significantly. A lot of the folks that started those ended up leaving just because it didn't work in that corporate structure. So I think we've already seen that in some of the past mergers when they've tried to acquire and play in this new world.
Well, I think that's true, but I also think that, you know, the individual ad agencies are really the ones that have the personalities. A lot of people claim that you can tell a ad agency one ad from an ad agency two just because they have a different style, a different feel, et cetera, et cetera. So if that, you know, if that is really true, then I don't think the merging of a whole bunch of sub companies is really going to, you know, the culture clash is going to come when they start to cut positions, because then it's going to be every man for himself.
Correct. And I think one of the unintended consequences that people don't think about, because we thought about the brands and we thought about the agencies, are the people who support the advertising agency. So with the rating services, the people who do qualitative data, suddenly in many spaces, there's 2 to 3 companies that provide that same information. And when one holding company wields that power, that may put those secondary supporters of our ad industry out of business. And that threatens innovation. And so, it's, I think, somewhat dangerous to the ad industry because players who provide those back-end services might not be as many, and then that stifles innovation.
Well, you know, that's interesting because, once again, the striving for increasing profit damages the actual product itself. And how often have we seen that?
Once or twice. Well, we're going to be watching for this merger. Obviously, a lot of regulators, both here in the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere, have to weigh in before anything happens. And we'll bring you the latest updates as they become available. I want to switch to our next topic. Liberal activists were really beside themselves with joy, at least for a day or two this past week, when Politico ran a story over the weekend saying that Cumulus Broadcasting was dumping Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity from 40 stations in some very big markets, including New York. Here's how Media Matters' David Brock spun it on Al Sharpton's MSNBC show, Politics Nation.
He's been a really important figure going all the way back to 1994 when he was largely credited with helping to bring in the Gingrich Congress, and which was referred to as the Limbaugh Congress. And you'll remember, on the day that President Obama was inaugurated, he was kind of the architect of the Republican strategy for these past years, saying, I hope he fails. So this is a defeat for Limbaugh. It's a victory for progressives in the sense that it's a victory for everybody who believes in civil discourse.
On the other hand, Limbaugh addressed the issue briefly on his own radio show 2 days ago. He says the spat with Cumulus is no big deal.
Nothing is going to change. You are going to be able to get this radio program on as many, if not more, radio stations down the road than it's on now. And what you're being treated to is just a public business negotiation.
So who's right, Stephanie? I mean, is this a big blow for conservative talk radio, the Tea Party, the Republicans, or is it just a business dispute that's not going to have very much impact on his listeners or his bottom line?
Well, I do believe it is a public negotiation, and we're not sure how it's going to come out. But I do believe that what has been affected are the activists and the people who are protesting any local advertiser. He is on what we call the do not buy list for many large clients. So as an agency, when I go and negotiate radio, sometimes I will say I cannot have my spot appear in. And Rush Limbaugh is a part of many major clients, Disney, CBS, people who spend a lot won't be in his show because those activists, when they see your commercial, will flood your social media very publicly with stop supporting Rush. So I do think the score is for those local folks that are trying to do a groundswell movement.
So has his image or his brand been damaged by sort of the boycott or social media campaigns against him or whatever label you want to use?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it certainly is a victory for them. I agree with Stephanie on that. I also think that it's interesting the power of the advertising dollar to actually control content here, because that's, you know, even if he shifts over to this other company, if there's advertising dollars involved, he's going to be threatened again because, you know, you have to make money some way or another. So he's angered a lot of activists that I think can really damage him in the long run.
If you look, however, just sort of the business deal in isolation, I mean, let's face it. I mean, Cumulus is a large radio holding company. Clear Channel, which distributes the Rush Limbaugh program and Sean Hannity's show, is an even bigger radio behemoth. And both Limbaugh and Hannity are the number one and number two talk radio programs in the country. Clear Channel has stations every place that Cumulus does. So really, is it going to matter in terms of audience size, at least, if this isn't just public negotiation with Cumulus, if he ends up going to Clear Channel, what does it matter in terms of the audience?
Well, I am not sure that audience size is the key factor. It's the syndication fees that they're paying. So if Clear Channel can pay 20% less to air a show that gets me lots of ears, it's a win to their bottom line. So I think what the real question or crux is, are what syndication fees are you going to pay to Premiere, I believe, is the syndicator of the Rush show.
Which is owned by Clear Channel.
Yes, I was going to say. So it's also, you know, okay, if I can protect my own and I want to protect my syndicated property, I can do that with my own outlets.
You know, the thing here that I think is also interesting is the fact that in the United States, we really focus on audience size. In many other countries, advertising is sold in terms of audience quality, like who you're getting specifically. So, yeah, they have a large audience size, but in terms of the activists and in terms of people who can actually have an impact on American companies, the quality is not as high.
I can imagine that this move, if it happens, could be a boon for some other talk show hosts. I mean, a lot of people have mentioned that Cumulus would give more of a profile in stations to Mike Huckabee, somebody who's seen as being maybe a more warm and fuzzy conservative. But I kind of wonder if those folks who are claiming this is going to somehow change the discourse with the shouters on the left and the right being muted or less listened to is really accurate, or if it's just sort of an anomaly there. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting because the left leaning groups have tried to create a force opposite of Rush, and they've tanked every single time. So they've put personalities out there. They've funded they funded radio networks specifically to deliver a liberal message, and they can't get the support. So it's this interesting push and pull that I'm going to protest the people I don't like, but yet I couldn't garner enough support to have my message heard at that same level. So it's interesting that to balance that message out. Mm-hmm.
Well, for the past couple of weeks, we've been sharing with our audience on Views the latest stats on women and minorities in newspaper newsrooms and also in newspaper stories. Well, this week, researcher Bob Papper with RTDNA, the broadcast group, released his annual report on women and minorities who are working in radio and television news. Now, TV especially has outperformed newspapers on these sort of traditional measures of diversity in the workforce, and that's true again this year, but they noted that women and minorities are still underrepresented in TV and radio as compared to the general population. No real surprise there. And there was very little change, Esther, in the numbers from last year to this. You can see the detailed stats on our links blog, but I wonder what, if any, conclusions we draw from these numbers from TV and radio.
Well, you know, I looked at the ASNE report on newspapers over time and their performance with hiring women and minorities, and then I compared it to the television ones. And they're you know, you're right. 2/3 of the folks involved in newspapers are men, and I guess it's only 60%. So I don't know how big an excitement that 6% difference is, but what struck me about those numbers over time is they just don't move. You know, we essentially have reached a point where there continues to be massive underrepresentation of women and minorities, but nobody has figured out a way to fix it because it may move up a little bit or down a little bit, but basically the numbers are flat over the last 10 years.
Surely the economy and media challenges and competition right now can't be helping any efforts to try to become more diverse, can it?
No, because unfortunately in a shrinking pool of jobs available, you're hiring fewer people. So if you have fewer people and you have traditionally been not diverse, the chance that you're going to become more diverse while letting people go, I don't think I see that happening.
Yeah. Well, we'd like to close this week with both a very personal and at the same time a highly public event that occurred this past week. NPR Weekend Edition host Scott Simon, who, by the way, is one of my favorite all-time interviewers and writers, decided to tweet his thoughts about and his conversations with his mother as she lay dying in a Chicago intensive care unit. More than 1 million people have followed Simon's reflections on Twitter. And those reflections produced some real tears, not unlike those at the end of this StoryCorps interview he did with his mom, Patricia, 5 years ago.
It's been a beautiful journey knowing you.
I'm sorry.
Oh, dear.
I cry all the time, too.
I know you
Where
cry.
Did I get that? Where did I get that from?
I don't know. I don't know.
I love you.
And I love you, sweetheart. And stop crying.
Simon's mom passed away Monday night. His latest tweet, tonight, a night to panhandle in Chicago. Put dollar bills into every open palm and said, from my mother, think I got a cop or two. Too much information, Esther, or is this really a worthwhile kind of story from a great writer that we should be talking about?
Well, it is a great story from a great writer. I think the key here for me is choice. You can listen to it, or you don't have to listen to it. But I do think that he has done a service for the American public because we do tend to hide death. And you know, experiences with your parents at the end of their lives are such a huge event for most of us that not to be able to share them, I think maybe damages us. So I have to applaud him.
And I like your word of choice, and I also think the other key word is authentic. You know, he was not told by his boss to go do this. It came from his heart, and I think you could tell that from the highly personal nature, and it wasn't an assignment he was given. It was something he did that was very authentic and resonated with
Well, and clearly he had dealt with the issue of privacy, so his mother knew. She didn't apparently quite understand what Twitter was, but she knew that he was sharing that in a way that many audience members would be touched, and she was willing to do that. I think privacy always has to be dealt with, though, because, you know, some people, their last few moments, they don't want tweeted or Facebooked or anything like that. So I think once you solve the issue of privacy, then you really give people a choice to see how actually end of life can be a very good learning experience.
So I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I will put you on the spot because you went through the very same thing in your own life not that long ago. So did you take anything from his reflections about his own mother's passing?
Well, I did. In fact, I had not even seen this story, so I was so glad when you brought it to our attention. I think his writing is something we all want to look at. He's apparently written about his family quite extensively. I'm actually writing about my father, who was a minister for 35 years, so I'm studying 35 years worth of sermons because I want to see how his sermons changed over time in response to societal changes. And so I'm going to become a fan of this guy because I think he has a lot to teach me.
He gave a great interview on All Things Considered last night, and he did share, as you mentioned, that his mother has been a public figure for a long time, so he didn't feel problems with the privacy issue. One of the things I thought, Stephanie, that was kind of interesting is when we talk about Twitter and the power of Twitter, which we do on this show quite a bit, we're talking about the Arab Spring or some other really big public story like this. It's about policy, usually. Was this another example, maybe even a better example of the power of Twitter?
I do. I think that it is that human real-time communication. He didn't have to put that through an editor. He didn't have to wait for 3 hours to get it approved and printed and shared. It was immediate.
Yes, exactly. But I just have to say that if you'll recall, when Twitter first came out, a reporter tweeted a funeral of a little girl. And the outrage of that activity was incredible. Now it's what, 5-6 years later, and we've societally we have changed in terms of what it means to share. And I think that that's really a change to look at in an important way.
Well, and what's interesting, in the same week, there was a young news anchor that lost her job because of a blog post that she thought was personal and said what she has done as a TV reporter that cost her job. So we can use it properly to share a beautiful story, or we can use it improperly and find ourselves unemployed. And it's a very hard line to teach.
Absolutely.
And sometimes we don't know where that line is.
And that's going to have to be the last word for this week's program. Thanks to Esther and Stephanie for sharing their insights and opinions. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan and KBIA's Pat Akers for producing the show. And thanks to you for watching and listening. Video and audio are available on our blog, along with links to background on today's topics, including Scott Simon's Twitter feed. We're under the talk show's tab at kbia.org. We welcome your questions, comments, or story suggestions as well. You can send them via email to views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. I'll be off next Wednesday, so join Amy Simons as she hosts our next edition of KBIA's Views of the News.